trying to pull the loose ends together again for you. And we were beginning to give you just a quick summary of Hebrews. I mean, these truths we talk about, which have to do with the interaction between God and man, a totally incomprehensible interaction on normal terms, and its implications are very complex, and those implications require a lot of analysis and thought. Well, I shouldn't say they require it. I should say in the counterculture meaning the culture that is counter to God. It's the counter to the God culture, if you would like to say that. But we live in a very complex society. It's in part complex because of the image of God in us. We have in the human scene relics of that image. A relic of the image of God, which is kind of like an eclipse, which shows the radiations of the sun coming out from behind. The rays come out from behind. We know the sun is there because of the radiation. King James text says, God breathed it and made him out of the dust of the earth. Well, that's a very common word for what was really true. And if you take the particular essence of the universe, the particles out of which it is made, which all are the same, the atom is the fundamental unit that we work with, although the atom obviously has been broken down to include many parts and ever more understanding of the elements of an atom are brought to light. But let's take the atom per se as the basic unit of creation, a basic unit out of which all elements of the universe were made, from the aardvark in Africa to the Eskimo in Alaska, you know, and everything in the universe is reduced to atoms, one single unit, and they're made up of the same atom, just in a different relationship, different organization. But it's all the same, and in fact, we are made of the same atoms that stars are made of. And sometimes we're likened to the stars in the universe. We're all of the same substance. And so to say that man was made out of the dust of the earth is a very simplistic way of saying that we're all made up of the same building blocks that God evolved or developed. From the point of our atomic structure, original atomic structure, many changes have taken place throughout the history of man, civilization. But the main point here is that this collection of atoms, which we might call ourselves, well, that's kind of a base way to talk about humans as a collection of atoms, but we are, after all. But this particular collection of atoms differs from the animal realm in the spirit factor, but differs from all other elements, even though we're made of the same atoms as cabbages, you know. We are slightly elevated above the cabbage. The difference was that God breathed into this collection of atoms, which made up humans, the breath of life, the nishmah hayah, which I have explained to you, is different than just air or wind. The word in Hebrew for air or breath wind or whatever is ruach, but this is a special word that God breathed into man, the nishmachayah, which was his breath of life. The same word later in the Hebrew text has been used to designate fire and lightning and things of that type. So it was a divine breath, not just wind. Now that divine breath breathed into the collection of atoms made it very, very special in terms of its focus and sensitivity to the things of God. Now in the fall, when we got off the track, maybe a better way to say it, because in that point, we lost the divine factor to us. We still retained the spirit that is supra-animal, a spirit that has a vast difference between ourselves and the animal, even though they can talk all they want to about the human characteristics of gorillas, and yet you see a lot of human beings that you might think ought to be in a cage. Simian similarities. An ape might be very intelligent about a lot of things and knows how to eat a banana by peeling it first. An ape can peel a banana, but he can't make a banana cream pie, you know. An ape can swing in the trees, but he can't cut the tree down and make a house out of it. That's a vast difference. In fact, that's the word culture is based on that. Culture, our English word, comes from the Latin cultare, which means to make or build, and that's the difference. An ape lives in the tree, and a man cuts the tree down and makes a house out of it. But even at the level of intelligence, you could color a keyboard, and an ape could type out its name, theoretically. But that's the outer limits. You can't write a book. Be nice to have a biography of a simian somewhere that we can check things out, but they can't. I mean, there's no capacity, and we've said before, and very worth repeating, I think, that the lack of a forehead in animals is a lack of a space within the cranial cavity for the frontal lobe of the brain, which is the area of integrated thought. So the animal has very little forehead, dog, ape, whatever, and goes right back from the supraorbital ridge to the crown, eliminating that area where the frontal lobe is, which is the area of integrated thought, which enables us to put phonemes together and make a language and write a book. Now, at the crown of the head is the motor area and sensory area, and of course, animals function on the basis of instinct or intuition, if you call it, but animal instinct can be a great deal. And of course, humans have a great capacity to put together animal behavior into its own patterns. So they think an animal, for example, is thinking what they're thinking, you know. And they tell the animal to do something, the animal probably responds to sounds, variations, rather than interpreting the words dictionary fashion. And when the tone of your voice probably does more to bring about animal behavior than the actual phonemes of language. But people like to apply things, just like a dog's loyalty and devotion and all those things are legendary, may have a slightly different interpretation to the animal than to the human, who likes to put together fantasies about animals and how they relate to people. I'm not going to go further with that because I don't want to step on any toes, because there are people who think that animals have souls and that they're going to be slated for heaven or something. I don't know. It would be nice to have some animals in heaven, I think. But I don't know if they're going there. Right? But anyway, the Bible doesn't give us that implication. But nevertheless, the point I'm trying to make here is that the human is elevated above the animal at such a tremendous level that it puts him within a framework that he can think God's thoughts after him. He can integrate with God. Now, going back to the original point, when man got out of step with God, and I want to leave it there because there are a lot of gaps in the Genesis account that allow certain factors that keep it from the idea from being extreme as to why God withdrew his spirit from humans. It may have been a lot more complicated than just on a given day picking a piece of fruit from a forbidden tree and eating it. That seems an extremely limited act to bring about all the retribution that has come to the race of humankind since then. If I arrive before our Lord and he says, "Why did you say that?" I'll say, "I guess I just was stupid. I don't know." But I think we limit ourselves too much. And if you're in a discussion with somebody and they like to believe it took a lot more than just one piece of fruit to cause God to withdraw from the race, I'll let them have that. Don't argue the point. And the next thing you know, they're out of the garden. Probably not one weekend after the weekend they were first made. There's probably a lot more in there that is not disclosed to us. I think I probably told you some child brought a artwork home, and it always has to be very highly praised in spite of not knowing exactly what it is. And you don't dare say that. If a child brings an artwork home, you never say what is it. So anyway, so the person is wondering about it, and it shows a picture of God driving an automobile, big long convertible. Adam and Eve are in the back seat. And the label is God driving Adam and Eve out of the garden. Given the fact that there are a lot of things in the evolving of humans that are not known to us, and that there are large numbers of years involved, ages involved, this has a point. Stick with me. We'll give you a point. Probably the bottom line should be, before I go on, don't try to debate with people over what exactly happened in the development of mankind. Chances are neither of you know what went on. You can't debate that subject. We have no idea fundamentally, for example, what was God doing before he made anything. You see in Genesis 1, it says, "Bereshit bara," in beginning, God made the heaven and the earth. That first word, in beginning, one word in Hebrew, that first word says to us, you have no way to handle anything behind that word. Beginning is a space-time word. And we are space-time creatures, and our brains are limited to that. And we are therefore completely unable to handle anything back of that time point. Beginning, that's for us, beginning. And we, no use even speculating what God was doing or anything like that. All right, so now, there's so much we don't know or comprehend, and we're better to just let it float and understand that God was essentially involved in putting this whole thing together. And that even if there were some evolutionary process, where does the first Adam come from? You have to start with an Adam no matter what you believe. So where'd that come from? You either have to say God was eternal or the Adam was eternal. Now, I'm going to get out of that quagmire and get on with the other one. Now what I'm trying to get across here, but going back earlier, is that there was some process, probably not instantly happening, where humans got out of step with God. And it could be the length of time being possible that there was a whole culture that evolved there that Adam and Eve got mixed up with, which was a contra-God or non-God culture. Whatever it was, they became mortals. Those who were immortal suddenly became mortal and subject to death. But the death was not an immediate execution, so to speak. God didn't execute them, but rather took from them the eternality factor and allowed them to be corruptible. That which was in the beginning incorruptible became corruptible. So the blood becomes a corrupting element within us. So that's true today. Blood is a corrupting element within us, subject to all kinds of dissolution. But man became mortal and lost the innate godness factor, which would put him constantly in touch with God. But he came out of touch with God. And that is the beginning of the whole biblical theme, which starts with, even though a sketchy outline of creation, but remember the sketchy factor. Don't get into debates about those things, because you don't know, and the person you're talking to doesn't know. And the less they know, the more vocal they will be about their beliefs. That's a given in debate. The less a person knows, the more adamantly they hold what they don't know. One sign of intelligence is flexibility. You have to be open to the things that you don't know. Well, anyway, there came a point in time when the human-divine connection was broken and had to be restored by a divine fiat, that is a substitute situation, like a scaffolding. It's almost as though God erected a scaffolding whereby in the use of animal sacrifices first, then the sacrifice of Christ, the problem was bridged over. So that whereas death was the result of the loss of connection with God, just as the lifeline might be cut to a diving bell, the connection was lost and God put it back together again with a temporary connection, which had to do with the substitute kind of death. The animal was a substitute for their own death. And later Christ was the fulfillment of the full substitute for human death. That's what the cross was all about. God, theoretically through Christ, shed blood that humans might not be responsible to pay that penalty. Now, where are we going from there? We're going to the point that if humans lost their connection with God, then what was the result in terms of their own capacities? And the answer obviously is that humans have great capacities. On the one hand, for technology, for incomprehensible developments, levels of development of technology and and assessment of the universe, scientific achievement, all of these things are obvious, but also still a capacity for the milk of human kindness, as you might call it. Humans are not like mechanical men, automatons, who are unable to feel or think creatively, as you might have expected when God's Spirit was removed. Because today, especially now at Christmas time, you have a great host of efforts on the part of humans, non-Christian as well as Christian, to engage in charities everywhere, almost to the point of badgering, you know, all the pots and buckets and everything that people have out there for you to contribute to. And when they press their case, I don't know how many actually get the money to the sources, to the places they're expecting to give it or saying they're going to give it. But I know even at the airports, they almost push you out of the way to give them some money, their little buckets. But, you know, they have their own causes, and I am not in a position to judge whether the causes are meritorious or not. But I'm just saying to you that all across this land at Christmas time, everywhere, the kind thing as well as the chic thing to do is to give. In the circles of what we call the noblesse oblige, which are the obligation of nobility, is the noblesse oblige. If you have lots and lots of money, you're kind of out of it if you don't share a little. Not too much, but at least you have to get a cause. It is as important if you're in the upper 400, if you're in the aristocratic section, it is as important to have a cause as it is to have money or the right clothes. You can have the best wardrobe in at the party, but if you do not have a cause you're working with, you're a little substandard. So that's Christian or not Christian. So I'm saying human acts of kindness across the country, not only now but through the year, reflect the radiation that comes out of the image of God in us that still remains. The Spirit of God is not with us at birth. We are not born into the world with the Spirit of God in us as Adam and Eve had in the beginning. The effect of that image of God is such that we have many different qualities as humans that reflect God-like qualities, many different qualities. And that is one of the evidences of the image of God. If we were merely evolved out of apes, that would not be an automatic part of the evolution. Even if you had survival of the fittest, where the only the ones that were fit or capable of it survived, even if you had that, that does not include social survival. See? It may include physical survival. Today, we have a contradiction in society. For on the one hand, people have become adept at telling each other, creating a lot of problems in society, felonious activities and so forth. On the other hand, you have an attitude on the part of large numbers of people that instead of saying now it's the survival of the fittest, we fight that concept. Otherwise you'd say, well, the people that are going to survive in the world are the people that have the biggest guns. But we don't go that way in human society. We go the other way. We say, well, let's not let the weak of society go out. See? Let's keep the weak surviving. We do it in many different ways. So that's part of this image of God in it. Now, That is a remnant of the image of God, because those things, those qualities of charity and kindness and sensitivity and so forth, do not reconnect us to God. They reflect God's original creation, but they do not reconnect us. We're only reconnected to God by His Spirit in us. A lot of people on the earth that act better than Christians, but they lack the life connection of Christians, using the term maybe in its best sense. So it's like members of the family, and I've tried to convey that point, that we are members of a family, the family of God. We're not religious people or religious participants, members of a religious society. That's not our place at all, but part of a family of God. Thus, therefore, religious systems don't do the job for us. Everybody has a system of religion, and the denominations have their systems. And they've got points A, B, C, and D, and 1, 2, 3, and 4. They've got 10 steps and 5 steps and 2 steps and all different kinds of steps. They have regulations and rules that identify you as a member of their particular society. They have their different rituals or different religious activities. And if you do these things, you are a part of their group. And if you are really, really a Christian, you will, in their mind, do the things that they want you to do. They have the rules all laid out. So that is a systematic kind of religious connection. But the truth of the matter, as the Bible gives it, is that those are not the essence of a connection to God, but a lifeline, a life involvement where the Spirit of Christ comes into our spirits. Now, people can use systems if they want. Religious systems are something people will always probably seek. But the truth of the matter is that it's the Spirit of Christ in us that makes us Christians, and not a system of belief or a system of religious observance. What do Christians do? Well, what do the members of your family do? Do you identify the members of your own family by the way they behave? Probably not. But it's by the connection, the life connection, which came through birth. So remember, your child was born to you in that sense, in the sense of a birth process. And in those cases where the connection is by birth, no matter what the child does, they're still connected by birth. You may want to disown them, or you may want to do a lot of things, but they're still connected in a life sense. We are, in God's situation, connected in two ways. We're connected by adoption, but we're also connected by a life factor, by birth, by being born to God. We're both adopted and born. Now, in many cases in the human family, people are adopted and they remain as members of the family. In the case of God, we're not only adopted, but we're also given life. And part of His Spirit is born in us. So the Spirit of Christ is in us. The connection was reconnected through the coming of Christ, through His participating as a human on the earth, and through the giving of His life as a sacrifice. So in a sense, God reached out from eternity and picked up the humans and made them part of his family. The only thing that doesn't make that an absurdity, an utter absurdity, that God would possess particles in space, is that Jesus himself came to be a human on the earth and to function as humans, and therefore showing that a human could indeed possess the Spirit of God. And in fact, the Bible, one of the things that validates the Bible is that such a system is presented. There's no other religious book in the long history of religious writings. I'm thinking in terms of the major epical works like the Quran and the Vedas and the Sutras and so forth. That does this, that makes that kind of connection that will say God himself brought a son into the world through and projected himself as a son, in a way, in a sonship relationship. But not only sons, I think a lot of religious groups see humans as sons of God. But where God becomes also, through Jesus, our brother. And that's what Hebrews brings out. I was going to get to that in a different way, but I didn't get to it. Hebrews brings out the fact that Jesus, who came to the earth as God's representative, or as God himself in a way, God projected to earth in a son. But that son became so much one with the human race that he could identify himself as our brother. We are brothers and sisters to Christ. In that kind of a family connection. Now, you can get all kinds of spiritualizations in other religious writings about God dealing with man. But nowhere where we become such an intimate part of God's family as to be brothers and sisters of Christ. And joint heirs with him. We are heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. We are possessors of the divine nature. Now the pantheist will say that God is in everything and everything is in God and we're all one thing. That's not what the Bible is saying. The Bible keeps an individuality to God and to us. God is other and yet has so identified himself with us that we are members of his family. And that is the basis on which we live on the earth as Christians. Although I don't know a word to use as a substitute, but the word Christian has become so sated with religious systems. And to become a Christian means you joined a church or a society and adopted their rules and regulations. I probably couldn't join any church in the country. I wouldn't be willing to sign their creed because I'm not sure their creed is all that precisely accurate. One group that I had some connection with wanted me to write a paper showing from the Greek text that certain of their precepts were correct. I said, I can't do that because the Greek text doesn't support your precepts. That to the national headquarters who, looking upon me as a bright-eyed young man. But anyway, that is true. I'd have to go over all their creeds and rules and regulation and strike a lot of them, not because they are not welcome to have them if they want. None of those things really keep a person from being a member of the family of God. And these religious groups are perfectly welcome from my book or my point of view, to practice what they like. Without my saying to you, you're all out of step. They're doing whatever step they want to, the two-step or the five-step or whatever. I have the liberty, and you have it, of saying I'm a member of the family of God, not because I subscribe to your rules and regulations, but because I have Christ in my spirit. And I live my life in the way that my life has to be lived. That's a great liberty. You can be who you are. You don't have to be what somebody else thinks you ought to be. That doesn't give you liberty to act immorally. But remember, behavior is a matter of consequences, and a lot that the Bible has to say would prevent us from paying certain heavy bills. Consequences. Remember, I've said to you before, old Barron said, he says, I'm not a moralist, I'm a consequentialist. Okay, that was his approach. But we're all consequentialists. In other words, the Bible tries to prevent us from making a lot of mistakes that would get us in trouble. It doesn't say these things are going to keep us out of heaven. But we can get into a lot of trouble on earth. And we have an increasing number of things that are consequences to misbehavior, as you know. Our society becomes more and more complex in that factor. Some large groups will even fight you for the privilege of paying those consequences. This Christmas season, not too far off the Christian message, the Christmas message, is that we're members of His family. We have our own way of relating to Christ individually. And we have the privilege of doing that. If this Christmas season people want to have their own way of celebrating, that's fine. They can celebrate whatever way satisfies their situation, you see, their needs, personally. And some may be very, very quiet and may feel they don't want to be part of all of the folderol, as they call it. And some people will get a great pleasure out of the things that they do, and so why not? Don't let anybody else dictate to you how you should observe it. There's nothing in the Bible anywhere that says how you ought to observe Christmas or whether or not you ought to observe it. If somebody sidles up to you and says, now Christmas is really a pagan holiday, just tell them to go jump in the lake. Tell them, if you weren't as ignorant as I might follow your advice. That's true. It's all out of ignorance. Misrepresentations, misapplications, misreading of history, misapplying of history. So we're all fools on the earth, so you get involved in your own folly. You follow your own folly, okay? Good thing to make as an epithet. Follow your folly. Say, follow your own. Don't follow somebody else's folly, because it's all in the same category. As far as earthly observances are concerned, how you function, the traditions of your family and so forth. Traditions are a nice thing. And traditions have a good psychological effect because they give some structure. I'm not against those traditions. In your family, the way you observe your holidays and whether you observe them or not and so forth. Be what you have to be. But remember, the controlling point here of being a Christian, using the word in its best form. I don't like it, but I'll use it. Being a Christian is that you belong to Christ. That's the essence of it. Be at peace. Christ came to give you peace on the earth. So have the peace. Even if your earthly circumstances are kind of tangled up. In your spirit, with the presence of Christ there, you can be at peace. And you can have your own corner of the sandbox, build your sandcastles, get them knocked down, squirt water on each other, and so on. But in the end, and we're all members of the sandbox, in the end you have your way of relating to Christ, and other people have their way. Now, that does not say there are many ways to get to Christ. No, Christ, come to Christ only through His sacrifice, only through His Spirit. You can't just choose your way to relate to God in that sense. It's only if you have the Spirit of Christ in you, then that's the essence of your relationship. Well, I've got to stop here.